and welcome to South Talk Radio. I'm Joe Quinn, and my co-hosts this week are Neil Bradley.
Hi, everyone.
Laura. And Harrison Cooley.
Hi there.
Did I say your name right, Harrison?
How did you say it?
Cooley?
That's the technically precise way to play it.
Excellent.
Say it.
I like to be technically precise.
But I've known him as Keeley. It's more Irish sounding.
It's actually
tend to be Irish people.
Well, it it's not spelt in an Irish way, so it doesn't get away with that one. Anyway, this week we are hopefully going to be talking to William Patrick Patterson. Actually, did everybody say hello? Say hello, Laura.
Hello.
Say hello, Neil.
Hello.
Did you say hello?
Yes.
Okay. This week we're hopefully going to be talking to William Patrick Patterson. Mr. Patterson is a spiritual teacher of the Fourth Way, which is an ancient esoteric teaching of self-development brought to the West by G.I. Gurdjieff. Mr. Patterson is also an author, filmmaker, and speaker on spiritual themes, including The Fourth Way, Being and Becoming, Advaita Vedanta, Self-Awakening, Self-Observation, Esoteric Christianity, and Cosmic Body Breath Impressions, all of which sound very interesting. He is also the founder and director of the Gurdjieff Legacy Foundation, through which he teaches study groups as well as seminars, workshops, and talks on Fourth Way themes. Mr. Patterson has also founded and directs the Gurdjieff Studies Program, which allows students living out of the reach of ongoing Gurdjieff Legacy Foundation groups to participate and study through correspondence, seminars, and scheduled private meetings. He has written 9 books, the latest of which is Georgi Ivanovich Gurdjieff, The Man Teaching His Mission, and you purchase it from his website, which is gurdjieflegacy.org. Do any of our guests here today have anything insightful to say about the topic that we're discussing?
Mr. Patterson's latest book is Georgi Ivanovich Gurdjieff. Joe read it out earlier. The Man, the Teaching, His Mission. It is it's a comprehensive tome. It is a serious book. I think of all the books, this one he put 10 years, he says, of research into. He had written a lot on Gurdjieff beforehand. This one is probably his magnum opus. We'll get him to confirm that himself. I know, Harrison, you've read it.
Yes, I have. And
what do you think?
Well, I quite enjoyed it. It's structured in such a way that it takes you from basically Gurdjieff's birth until his death, and it's completely chronological. It's not necessarily a traditional biography. It takes you through events, anecdotes, little stories culled from all the sources on Gurdjieff, so books written by his students and by just outside observers who had a glimpse into the, you know, this world of Gurdjieff and his work. And so it follows Gurdjieff's teaching, the things he did day by day, the phases of his life, and also the lives of some of his major students like Alfred Orage and P.D. Uspensky and J.G. Bennett. So it follows them, their students, and how all the stories intertwine. So it's quite in-depth. It has a similar structure as several of his other books. For our readers who may have read some of his stuff, he's written Struggle of the Magicians, Ladies of the Rope.
Yeah, I read that one.
Great beer, yeah.
Yeah, and those are kind of structured in a similar way with little anecdotes from in chronological order, just showing the interaction between these people and the things that they did. And so there's some great stories in there. Some things that I hadn't heard of, but I hadn't read before. It's very difficult to read all the material on Gurdjieff. There are just hundreds of books. So I think Mr. Patterson did a great service by writing this book and putting all of these just little tidbits together to create this overarching narrative that shows, you know, Gurdjieff's life.
Yeah, I love how there's interspersed. You've got a kind of a chronology of world historical events going on at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Not necessarily directly related to what Gurdjieff was doing, but Mr. Patterson sort of lets you know, okay, this was going on at this time when this happened. And it's very interesting, especially as we're looking back at recently, we've been talking a lot about the Russian Revolution, that period of time when it was great change in Russia. Of course, Gurdjieff, his work began in that fire of revolutionary activity, and his story about how he eventually got to France and then set up in the US
And even in France, then he went through the Nazi occupation.
Yeah, okay, we have Mr. Patterson on the line now, so we're going to go ahead and... Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Mr. Patterson.
How are you today?
Pretty good, how are you?
Wondering if we're going to make it here.
Yeah, absolutely.
We usually have
a few glitches, you know, but we get there in the end.
Okay.
So we're live right now because the show is a scheduled start time. We did a quick kind of bio intro with the standard kind of stuff, you know, for you, and it's myself, Joe, Laura, Neil, and Harrison on the kind of on the mics here. We're just, you know, we're all kind of interested in the topic, and so we're just going to be putting some questions your way, if that's okay with you.
Okay, so there's more than two then.
Yeah, there's four of us. We have these people.
Oh my!
Tend to hangers on, you know.
Okay.
Hi there.
But
hi.
It keeps it a bit more interesting, I suppose. Different perspectives and different ideas, you know. Anyway, I suppose I should first of all thank you for being on the show. We all of us really appreciate the kind of work you've done in bringing the life and times and teachings of Gurdjieff, to the world, I suppose, in a large sense, because you are one of the main kind of authors of Gurdjieff works and books on the life of Gurdjieff. Maybe you could tell us a little bit. I mean, it's in your bio, I suppose, somewhere on the web, but how you actually got involved in the Gurdjieff work and what your history is, I suppose, in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, it happened in 1963. I went to a bookstore in Manhattan, New York City, and I'm looking at all the books, and I feel like I've read them all just by looking at the covers or the titles. I hadn't been drinking. I didn't smoke pot. It just happened. And I stood there for I don't know how long. Finally, the manager came up and said, "Well, what are you looking for?" And I said, "I don't know. Everything here I've already read." And of course, there's probably 20,000 titles. And he looked at me like I was a little screwy. And he said, "Oh, you want something seminal?" And I said, "Yes, that was the word." So he gave me Meetings with Remarkable Men. I went back. I read it. That was Friday evening. I went back on Monday morning Monday after work, and the bookstore was closed. There was nobody there. It was the strangest book I'd ever read because the author is telling you something but hiding something at the same time. So it just leaves you with a question. And so at that time, I tried to find people in the Gurdjieff work. Anybody I met was interesting. I would ask them. Nobody knew about the Gurdjieff work then. And then in 1969, I read In Search of the Miraculous and still looked. And this was an amazing book. I was a major in philosophy, psychology, English in college. And every philosopher was wonderful to read, but it was like a chess match. The next philosopher made another move, and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. So I realized it wasn't in philosophy. And in psychology, the teacher said, all things being equal, this will happen. And I raised my hand, and I said, "Well, when are all things equal?" He said, "Never." So I walked out. That was it for psychology. I got my degree, but I was no longer interested. And I had a magazine in New York called In New York. I sold it to a company who then went bankrupt. And so I was out of a job. I was another creditor. And I was just dumbfounded. I went to every morning I would go and pick up the New York Times, and I overheard a man who turned out to be Peter Riley, who wrote New Gods in America. And I said to him, have you ever heard of the Gurdjieff work? And he said, yes, I just spoke to the leader of the Gurdjieff work yesterday. And so I said, could I speak to him? So he said, well, I have to give you a call. So he did, and I called Lord Pentland, and he said to me, what do you want? And it just stopped me totally. I mean, I'd been looking all these years. What did I want? And he said, well, you could see me this afternoon, or maybe Monday would be a better time. And having looked all those years, I said, no, I want to see you now. So I went down and we talked, and he told me about a little bit about Gurdjieff and the work. And he had groups. And I wasn't very interested in joining a group. So I went home and I thought, well, this self-remembering sounds pretty easy to do. I don't need a group to do it. And so I did what Uspensky says about dividing the attention, and experiencing the feeling of the body, what have you. And it was in the wintertime. And I walked to the door, and I felt the coldness of the brass handle. I had lived there now 3 or 4 months, and I had never experienced that. Well, it wasn't a eureka moment, but I was still puzzled that never had I recognized that. And I went down the steps, and the steps creaked, and I'd never heard them creak. And I got outside, and there was a Sikh coming down the street. And I wondered whether he carried a knife or not. The next thing I know, I've mechanically gone down and bought the paper and talked to some people, paid for the paper, and come back. And I'm sitting down on a chair, and suddenly I realize I've been asleep all this time. And I realized when I went back and looked at it, what had happened, I'd been thinking about going to India. And so when I saw the Sikh, I went into a long association about India and what have you. And so I realized I couldn't do this myself. So I called Lord Pentland, and there it began.
I see. Well, you've touched on a couple of things here. This realization that you were asleep. I mean, if there's one thing that is really powerful behind Gurdjieff's basic teachings is that he's telling Uspensky in that eventually went into his book, The Search of the Miraculous, that you are asleep. And Uspensky, and of course anyone who's hearing this, would tend to reject this outright.
Absolutely.
And they should.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this
because
is it,
you have
you
to
tell...
verify it. Don't accept anything. That's mm-hmm.
well,
great parts of the Gurdjieff work.
Let me tell you really quick what happened. I'd spent many years studying esoteric topics, psychology, biology, etc. And I was bedridden at one point after having my third child. And I had this copy of In Search of the Miraculous that I had picked up on a sale table in a bookstore. And it was probably one of the only books around me that I hadn't read. And being bedridden, I thought, well, okay, I'm forced to be in bed, so I'll read this book. And I have to tell you that it made me so angry. And I tell people the story about, you know, how I would read and then he would say something and I would throw the book across the room against the wall. And then I would fume. I would just be so angry and I would fume about it. And then after a while I'd start thinking, well, you know, he's probably right. And then I would get one of the kids to pick it up and bring it back to me. And I would start reading again. And I think I must have thrown it against the wall about 4 or 5 times before I gave up throwing it against the wall. And I still have that copy held together with duct tape. You know? So that was back in the 80s.
Yeah, one of the things I find fascinating, and also fascinating in the context of some things that Gurdjieff has said, is that a lot of the things that he talked about in the ways that he talked about them, about man being asleep and man being a machine, human beings being machines, essentially unconscious, is that a lot of this is being a lot of these ideas are being pretty much proven with kind of cutting edge cognitive psychology. I don't know if you're aware of there's different books out there called Thinking Fast and Slow and Strangers to Ourselves, but they basically talk about that there being two kind of systems at a psychological or neurological level within human beings, and that there's a system behind the kind of conscious awareness that drives motivations, and that we're essentially unconscious of it, you know. So in reading those books, I thought it was very interesting that that a lot of the factor details in that from a scientific point of view are bearing out what Gurdjieff said, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago, you know.
Yeah, modern science is just proving everything he said was correct, that he was like, you know, light years ahead of everybody else. But I want to ask you this. Now, I read Struggle of the Magicians, and it was some time ago, I guess probably not long after it came out, and my husband read it. We both enjoyed it very much. It's a tremendous book. I haven't read this new one yet. Harrison has read it, and Neil has read part of it, and I've read part of it, and, of course, I looked at all the pictures. This is a hefty book, and it's got, like, everything. And you took 10 years to pull this together, right?
Yes, but I was writing other books at the time and doing other things.
Uh-huh. So was there anything about this that was particularly difficult? Did you have to do any travels or interview people to write this book?
Well, we had gone to all the major archives over the years. That was part of it, to assemble this material. That was the major thing to do. After Eating the Eye, which was the first book, I wrote Struggle with the Magicians, and that was essentially the template for the book that you're talking about now, The Man, the Teaching, His Mission.
Uh-huh.
So it was studying the work, practicing the work, and going to archives, occasionally talking to people, what you do in producing a book.
Right. Was there any part of it that was particularly difficult?
The end.
Oh, yeah.
We had to make it to the printers, and all sorts of things suddenly were happening that had never happened in any of the other eight books. And people were making mistakes they had never made before. It was like there was something that didn't want this book to be published. And finally, when I sent it off, I thought I came down with eye allergies, all sorts of stuff with the stress of putting this out. I thought I had asthma, but I didn't have asthma. I had a 90% blockage in one artery. And so when we sent the book off, it wasn't too long after that, I went to the hospital and had a 2-stent surgery. And, you know, you never know whether you're going to survive anything.
Right.
So my only wish was that if I was going to die, I would hope that I would live long enough to see the book. And so I've seen the book, and I'm still here, and it's been great.
Let me ask you. You call it The Man, the Teaching, His Mission.
Right.
I would like to approach this just from the from the back end of it there. What was, in your words, based on everything you've read, studied, learned, heard, what was Gurdjieff's mission? Can you tell us, tell the audience?
Well, he said that unless the wisdom of the East and the energy of the West could be harnessed and used harmoniously, the world would be destroyed. The world is functionally awake, but there's not real awareness. And because of that, we are very suggestible. And because of that, there is a periodic need for the destruction of other people, which is why we see war after war after war. And as Einstein said, if there is a third world war, the fourth world war will be fought with sticks and stones. So Gurdjieff felt that he had to give a major shock to the West and bring this ancient esoteric sacred teaching he had discovered and reformulated to the West, and decided the entryway would be Russia. And he started there in 1912.
Okay. So that's his mission. Now let's go to the next one, the teaching. Can you synopsize for our audience the teaching and how he went about doing it?
Well, the teaching fundamentally is that we are asleep. We have no will. We can't really do. But we are functionally awake, and some people are very highly functionally awake. We basically are living out of one of three centers, the instinctual, sexual, the emotional, or the mental. And in this culture, being so mental, most people are living out of the mental in one sense or another. Not the deep mind, but the formatory mind. The mind that if people listen to themselves, they'll see you're always talking to yourself about what? About yourself, because we are all coated with self-love and vanity. Everything is a reference to myself, even if I'm doing quote-unquote good works and what have you. So it's to become aware of myself, and that's the question. How do I become aware of myself if I'm asleep? And so the chief practice is self-remembering. And in self-remembering, then there's self-observation. You observe what? You observe the eye of the moment, what you're thinking, feeling, the impulses, what have you. And you will be you'll easily be able to see, verify that you're not one eye, but many eyes. So the over a course of time, because there will be resistance, this idea will suddenly come to your emotional center, that you are not one eye, but you are many eyes, that you're not an individual, and you're not really in awareness, and so forth and so on. And here's a teaching that can bring you through the various psychological, physical patterns to a real I. And I might read something here from... let's see, it's Fritz Peters, Boyhood with Gurdjieff. He says, the philosophies, religions, and other movements had all failed to accomplish this aim of waking people up. And the only possible way to accomplish it was through the individual development of man. As an individual developed his own unknown potentialities. And by the way, when he says man, he means men and women. Man is the active source.
Right.
As an individual developed his own unknown potentialities, he would become strong and would in turn influence many more people. If enough individuals could develop themselves, even partially, into genuine natural men, able to use the real potentialities that were proper to mankind, each such individual will then be able to convince and win over as many as 100 other men, who would, each in his turn, upon achieving development, be able to influence another 100 or so. Gurdjieff added, rather grimly, that he was in no sense joking when he had said that time was short. Further, he said that history had already proven to us that such tools as politics, religion, and any other organized movement which treated man in the mass, quote-unquote, and not as individual beings, were failures. That they would always be failures, and that separate, distinct growth of each individual in the world was the only possible solution.
Wow. And that's, okay, let me back up to one thing you just said a minute ago, and then I want to come back to what Peter said. You said that it finally comes into your emotional center. Your emotional center becomes aware that you really aren't awake, you know, that this is like
right.
an emotional. It seems to me that that awareness, if you really achieve that, should scare the hell out of you. I mean, it should be terrifying.
That's why you have to be in a teaching. If you don't, yes, you'll be terrified. You won't go to excess in one sense or another. You see that people doing it all the time with drugs, drink, and so forth. So you can't wake yourself up. You have to be with a teacher.
Of course not.
He or she will be there to give you
Shock
the support you. And trust you need to go beyond that. Because deeply, if you ask the student, what is it that knows that you are now multiple eyes? And he or she won't know, of course. But the answer is that which we all are and always are, developed or undeveloped consciousness.
The real eye. Yeah. Yeah, because something has to know that. Something has to be aware of that. Because,
right.
And when that awareness comes, it's horrifying. I mean, it can lay you flat on your back. You know, you can sit there in a state of abject terror for days on end.
It interested me. I didn't react in that way. I thought, wow, this is incredible that
I did.
I could have all these eyes, right? And think that I was an individual all this time. And having recognized the variations in my eyes, I began to look at other people as I had never looked at them before.
Uh-huh.
And life became even more interesting.
Well, getting back to this destruction problem, and obviously Gurdjieff was very concerned about this, concerned enough that he put himself at great risk on many occasions. He lived through a lot of discomfort. He sacrificed an enormous amount, you know, in many ways to do what he was doing because he really, really had this mission. And here Fritz Peters mentions it also, that the world will be destroyed. And then you mentioned Einstein's comment about if there was a third world war, that the fourth world war would be fought with sticks and stones. So
excuse me a moment. What I was reading was what Fritz Peters wrote about what Gurdjieff said.
Right.
Fritz Peters
exactly.
didn't say that. Yeah. Okay.
Right, right. But I was just referring to it as having been written by Fritz Peters rather than
– Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the thing is that if – do you see this imminent destruction before us now?
Well, who can see into the future really? But it certainly doesn't look good. But the question for each individual – I mean – whether there's a large war or not, there's nothing I can do about it. As Ouspensky says, they're big creatures. What I can do is work on myself to become more and more available for higher energies and to develop a Keshden body, or some people call it an astral body, but it's a little more than that,
right.
And eventually a soul. So whether the world will end with us fighting with sticks or stones or not, I can't tell and I can't influence, but I can influence my world and develop myself no matter what is happening. And I think that should be the basis for everyone. And in doing that, you receive higher and higher energies and transmit them. And if enough people come to doing that, it will certainly have an influence. Whether it has an influence large enough to avert our suggestibility for reciprocal destruction, I don't know. I hope so. Gurdjieff says, I might say, in all and everything, when he talks about the terror of the situation. And he says, if this property, this need to periodically destroy each other's existence, is to disappear, then it will be with time alone, and time is a capital T, thanks either to the guidance of a certain being with very high reason or to certain exceptional cosmic events. He says no more than that, but that perhaps is a reason for not rejoicing, but praying and hoping.
Yes, indeed.
Well, what do you think he meant by certain cosmic events? Do you have
I have no idea.
No idea. Okay, just wondering.
No. Okay, so let's go to the first item on your list, which is, I'm working backwards here, the man. If you could describe Gurdjieff as your, you know, as you've received the impressions of him through interacting with people who knew him, reading his writings, or hearing stories about him, what kind of a man was he in your estimation?
Well, we have to begin at the beginning, I think. It occurs in Meetings with Remarkable Men, the second series of books of his Legomenism, where he is on artillery range because of a love rivalry with another young man. And they decide that God will decide who will have the woman. They go out into the artillery range, and the shells start falling. And they both pull through, but Gurdjieff has come to, as he says, the complete sensation of himself, right? The complete sensation. We all
no
have
doubt.
Sensations, but complete sensation. And then having come to that realization, he looks around and he sees the suffering and misery of human beings. And so he comes to the question, what is the sense of significance of life on Earth and human life in particular? And this is a question that drives his whole life, because to understand this then brings him to, well, first it brings him to Ani, which is about 30 miles away from where he lives. And he and another person find in an underground passage a parchment from the Sarmung Brotherhood, speaking about some very interesting ideas. He had studied the religion and the science of his day, but he found no adequate answer to his question. But he felt then the ancient wisdom societies might have the answer. And so this was down around Iraq, where Iraq is today. And on the way down there, he stopped in to visit a priest who showed him a map of pre-sand Egypt. He doesn't say what he saw on the map, but we know what he did. He pre-sand Egypt means Egypt before 4000 BC. He immediately goes to the Giza Plateau. And there he becomes a guide. And why does he go there? I believe he went there because on the map he saw the Sphinx. The Sphinx is 2700 BC, according to most people. But here it was, I believe, or something, on the map. And that took him to Egypt. And there he becomes initiated four times into the ancient Egyptian mysteries. Not the Egypt religion we know today, which focuses on animals and so forth and so on, but a science of being, which was the original Egyptian religion. Over time, he recognizes that elements of the teaching have gone northward. So he makes a second trip now to discover the elements of the teaching that are missing. he finds those going to Tibet and the Hindu Kush and so forth and so on. And he puts it together now in a teaching that is modeled for the West, and he brings it to Russia, as I say, in 1912. Before doing that, I might say in 1911 he took a 21-year vow to live an artificial life. In other words, to be a teacher of other people. Anytime you adopt a identity, you can easily become identified with it and become the teacher or the president or whatever you are. And so you lose yourself. You fall asleep in being a teacher or a president, what have you. So he adopted a artificial role of a teacher and brought it to the West. I might say it's rather interesting that what I said before about his question about the sense and significance of life on Earth and human life in particular, he came to realize that we are part of the organic life on Earth, like the flora and fauna and what have you.
Right.
Our only difference is that we are three-centered beings, not two-centered or one. And everybody is doing just as great nature wishes us to do, just by being alive, moving around, and breathing. We don't have to do anything else. But we do have the potentiality, because, as he says, we are images of God, to develop ourselves. And this is the teaching that he brought. Before that, he had gone to several monasteries. He had become a hypnotic healer for 4 or 5 years. Then he became a quote-unquote professor instructor of supernatural sciences. And he said these automized people who have not opened themselves to themselves but have contented themselves with other people's fantasies, forming from them illusory conceptions and at the same time limiting themselves to a point of engaging upon authoritative discussions of all kinds of seemingly scientific, but for the most part, abstract themes. I'm looking at the Herald of Coming Good here. And he says, there are people who give themselves up to quasi-human knowledge, occultism, theosophy, spiritualism, he later added psychoanalysis. And he said that he became an expert and guide in evoking phenomena of the beyond, holding workshops for the perfection of these automatized psychological people. So that was where he came from. And he, of course, started the Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man in Moscow and St. Petersburg. The Russian Revolution drove him to Tiflis. Tiflis didn't work out, went to Constantinople, and then was drawn to Germany, England, and finally opened up his institute in France in 1922. Had a serious automobile accident in July 24 after returning from America, tremendously successful trip. And then he closed the institute and decided he would hurl the teaching in the future by writing a legomenism, All and Everything. And I might say, in terms of who he is, when I read in 1963 Meetings with Remarkable Men, it says at the beginning, according to traditional conceptions, the function of a master is not limited to the teaching of doctrines, but implies an actual incarnation of knowledge, thanks to which he can awaken other men and help them in their search simply by his presence. He is there to create conditions for an experience through which knowledge can be lived as fully as possible. This is the real key to the life of Gurdjieff. He is a master.
Well, I've got a question relating to that. The story of of him in the artillery field and coming to the full sensation of himself.
Right.
And it seems to me from his reaction to that, and even through reading about how he interacted with people, that he had not only a deep curiosity about humans as like almost like lab rats and studying them, but also a deep compassion. But at the same time, reading about how he interacted with people in general and his students in particular, some of his methods seemed almost cruel. And I was wondering if you could comment a bit about that and how Gurdjieff actually taught in life with his students.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, he would not like the word curiosity because it's very mental. How do you wake somebody up from where they are and where they believe they are and are defending at all costs? It can be a very slow way through Zen meditation, perhaps. I've done a little of that, but not very much. His way was to give you the practices of self-love or self-remembering and self-observation, so that the these are the guiding principles of life that then people are trying to be there when they're with him. And then in one way or another, he will show them where they are identified. And at the same time, he's got this amazing presence and love, but he's pushing your buttons so that you are caught in between. You love him, you hate him. And what could you come to through that? Well, you try to work it out. Loving, hating, whatever. What is he a master? Well, as I said before, what knows that you hate him at the moment? What knows you love him at the moment? That's what we all are, and that's where we're going, and that's what he's pointing to for everyone.
I think my favorite story is the one where he was recovering from his injuries, and he was in the being cared for by some local tribespeople or shepherds or whatever, and he could hear the gunfire in the distance, and he would go down and dip himself in this icy cold water and had this marvelous awakening. I don't remember all the exact details of it, but that story has stuck in my mind forever.
That's in the third series.
Uh-huh.
Life is real only then when I am.
I think he was shot. Was he shot twice and severely wounded?
Three times.
Yeah. By
accidentally. Stray bullets.
Yeah.
Do you think his stories about, where he went and what he did and how he got his information are all exactly according to, you know, what really happened, shall we say, or were they in a sense veiled or metaphoric, or do you think it all really happened the way he described it, or did he have a different intention in telling the stories?
I don't think so. I think he's very clear about what happened, him going to Egypt, being initiated four times, going to Tibet, the Sarmang Monastery there. Sarmang was a monastery that Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche represented, and he certainly picked up some of the elements that had come from ancient Egypt there, and then in the Hindu Kush and other places, he was gathering this material and putting it together into this teaching. And
has anybody ever followed in his footsteps and gone to the various places and basically kind of recreated the travels?
Not that I know of. To some degree, what's his name? The psychology fellow. what's his name?
Ichazo.
He said he went to the Asia, and then went to this Hindu Kush and what have you. Whether he did or not, I don't know.
Yeah, because I just think it would be a fascinating thing, because, you know, one of the things that I discovered, interestingly, doing some in-depth research into some of the ancient philosophies and ancient history, because I'm a historian, was that there are some really powerful similarities between the Stoic philosophy and some of the teachings of Gurdjieff. And it, and it kind of strikes me as astonishing and amazing and wonderful that there could have been such a tradition that was preserved and handed down, you know, which to me validates that he must have gotten these teachings from somewhere, because when you look into the teachings of the Stoics, you find these key words, these elements, these phrases, these ideas.
But if you go further than that, you'll go to Pythagoras.
Absolutely.
If you go further than that, Pythagoras spent 22 years in Egypt. He brought the Egyptian teaching, as it was, to Italy, and then to Greece, and then into the Middle East.
Even before Pythagoras, there was Orpheus. So, yeah, so it's all tied in together, and it's all this, I mean, Walter Burkert considers that Pythagoras and Orpheus were shamanistic type individuals of the Central Asian variety.
Oh, well, they started in Egypt. That's all I can say.
But how did it get to Egypt? Or from Egypt,
well,
or whatever.
If you read the first series,
right,
Gurdjieff speaks about Atlantis and the wise people of Atlantis understood that Atlantis would sink. And so they went to Egypt and they brought their teaching with them, and they gave that to the Egyptians of their time. And that created the Egyptian religion.
Which reminds me, you mentioned a while ago about this pre-sand Egypt map, right?
Right.
That it was before the change of climate that turned Egypt, or large parts of Egypt, into a desert, and the issue of the Sphinx, and then, you know, the currently accepted dating of the Sphinx. If this Sphinx was on this map, which we don't know because we don't know what was on the map, but if it was, and if it was pre-sand Egypt, then it was older than, you know, 2600 years or 2600 BC.
Of course.
So that's been validated also in recent years by Robert Schock, who did the geological study showing that the Sphinx was weathered by rain. Thousands of years of rain.
Right.
So Gurdjieff was an astonishing man. I mean, an astonishing man, absolutely astonishing.
Let me stop you here with this. A lot of people believe that the teaching is rooted in Sufism and comes from someplace in the Hindu Kush, what have you. J.G. Bennett, who was a pupil of Gurdjieff's, who spoke Turkish and many languages and what have you, is a chief proponent of that idea. But if you read In Search of the Miraculous, Gurdjieff is asked, what is the origin of the fourth way? And he says, and this is in Ital in the book, Esoteric Christianity, right?
Exactly.
And then if you look at the last pages or last chapter or so of Search, Uspensky has Gurdjieff saying that Christianity was known before Christ. It
exactly.
was known in Egypt, but not the Egypt we know about, right, through history and what have you. And so this is the origin. I think it's so plain, but people seem to want to deny that.
And that's there's another Stoic connection, because if you read Diogenes Laertius' biographies of the various philosophers and his citations of their different sayings, you find that there are sayings in there that later ended up in the New Testament being assigned to, quote, Jesus, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
It's, I mean, I don't know if we'd ever be able to untangle it. I've been working on it for 40 years, but it's fascinating, fascinating. And now I would like to shift gears just a little bit. Gurdjieff talks about the various worlds, you know, the levels of reality, if we want to call them that.
You mean cosmosis?
You're right. And my husband is a physicist and a specialist in hyperdimensional physics, and even wrote a book about it.
He must be really out there, huh?
Well, yeah. But in any event, he was working on this many years ago, and I'd say it was in 1966. What year did you find that book?
63.
Okay, so you were into it in 63. And I had this thing that I had written down. And let me read it to you, and I want you to give me a reaction to it. So what I had written was, now, a curious thing about the teachings of Gurdjieff is that he claims that man is food for something other. But there is a lack of really specific information about this other. We have often speculated, and I mean myself and my husband, as to whether Gurdjieff knew about hyperdimensional realities and just simply could not bring himself to tell anyone. Or if he did tell some of his students, was this something that only those on the inside knew and held back? My husband met with Henri Trekkel in Marseille in July of 1986. It was a brief meeting in an airport restaurant. Nope, not 1986. Yeah, 1986.
Yeah.
Lasting about 2 hours.
That's going backwards. But you could do that too, couldn't you?
Yeah. So his interest, my husband's interest, was in determining if joining with such a school as the Gurdjieff Foundation in Paris would be helpful to his own awakening. He asked many questions, most particularly relating to this idea of, quote, being eaten, unquote, by something. His assessment, and let me say my husband's assessments are pretty highly developed because he's been a scientist for many years and a professor. His assessment of Mr. Trekkel's reaction to this question was that the man was very uncomfortable about answering. As he recalls it, Mr. Trekkel glanced about nervously as though he might be overheard, although there was clearly no one to overhear, and made a somewhat vague allusion to interdimensional beings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he wrote in his journal, and that is still preserved, after this meeting, and this is my husband writing, "I am an energy transformer and converter. That is the essence of my existence. That is my only possible goal. I can choose to serve this goal or not. I can serve only as an energy transformer, so it seems to not make much difference what I do. The result will be the same. Or I can serve as a channel. This is the choice between self-will and discipline. What I, and that's in quotes, do, that is, I, personality, is self-will. What acts through me is not self-will. Thus, I wish to allow that which can act through me, that is not self-will. For this end, I need to eliminate self-will, but God forbid not to eliminate control. So I wish to eliminate self-will. I wish to eliminate identification. Eliminating identification is most important. I wish to self-remember. I wish to plan to account for each and every hour. I wish to get rid of my hump, to cease being a camel. How? through elimination of identification. And then he wrote some more, but basically this was the result of his conversation with Treckle about inquiring about hyperdimensional beings. So what do you think about hyperdimensional aspects of Gurdjieff's cosmoses? Do you think that that his terminology was just different and that we can look at this mathematically that way?
Well, if you look at the diagram of every living thing, you'll see that above man are angels and archangels. Right?
Right. Right.
So wouldn't they be interdimensional beings?
I would say so. I would definitely say so.
But I take it that your husband didn't go into the work then. Well, why not?
Because he was a director at the university and he really couldn't give up his job. But we have we've been involved with it with a small group with ourselves together and with others for many, many years.
In other words, you were teaching yourself then.
Well, not exactly. We had, like I said, we have a small group. And,
but who is teaching you then, if you're not?
Gurdjieff is.
Oh, okay.
We
through his writings.
We
you're channeling Gurdjieff.
Yeah, more or less. That's silly. Heavenly days. No, that's silly.
Well, why not? I mean, he says he is immortal within the solar system.
Well,
and so
I
is an interdimensional being.
Yes, I dream about him. And I had one dream one night where he came and you know, I have these dreams where, you know, it's like I actually get voices and everything. And I dreamed about him and I was puzzling over a problem for a particular individual for quite some time. And he came and he said to me, he said, you know, that person has been tortured. You know, that is nothing but torture. And you have to understand this. And they have been tortured into having all of these different eyes that, you know, in other words, it was as a result of this torture. And so, you know, I mean, it's like whenever I have a problem, Gurdjieff comes to me in dreams. I'm sorry. That's so silly. I know it.
Well, it's not so silly. I mean, he's had that kind of impact on people who have met him. Why not have that kind of impact? Well, clearly he has had that kind of impact on people who have met him decades after through books like Williams, Yuzmensky's and so on.
I read every word. I mean, I just eat it up.
You see, books can only take you so far.
I know.
They're a bee influence at best, and if they are bee, they'll soon become A. Gurdjieff brought a teaching, and to enter into it is to enter into a kind of moral suffering because you recognize you aren't what you thought you were, and all your goals and ideals and everything else are put in question. And so in living through that, working with self-remembering, self-observation, something develops in you. And eventually, out of this suffering and striving will come an inner separation between what you take to be yourself and what you are. And out of that, a Keshden body will begin to develop. And the physical will appear in the Keshden, not the other way around. So when you're remembering yourself, you're remembering from the Keshden and not the physical. And you're being developed.
Well, maybe that's what's happened over these years. I don't know. We've worked very, very hard. And actually, this radio show is one of the results of that work. You know, we spend a lot of time. But of course, like I said, my particular area is history and research and so forth, trying to find all the pieces to fit together to basically put the picture together. I mean, it's like, didn't Gurdjieff at one point say that, you know, learning history is part of knowing who you are?
That I don't recall that quote at all. But I'm just wondering, as you're talking, I can see you're very sincere in what you're saying, but isn't this just another I that is putting off really getting into the work? You want to know the history about it, but not the actual experiencing of it.
Oh, that may be so. That may be so. But at my age, it's a little
sure.
late.
Okay. I am 77. How old are you, young lady?
I'm 63.
Oh, my. I would love to be 63 and start.
You're young one still, Laura. William Gurdjieff was actually in the news recently, just in passing. I came across this article about this city. You've already mentioned it, the city of Ani.
Right.
Oh yeah, that was terrific.
It was crazy. So basically, researchers today are still discovering new underground chambers, cathedrals, tunnels. The city is growing basically underneath this location where Gurdjieff
said there was a city.
Said there was a city, and the article just in passing mentions that this city of Ani, the lost underground city of Ani, was first discovered by G.I. Gurdjieff 135 years ago, and researchers today are still. And then it moves on, you know. Oh,
just
nothing.
Yeah.
I didn't know he was the first. I mean, he accidentally found it, so he says. Right.
Oh, definitely.
And that set him off on his quest.
Yeah, he lived there for 3 or 4 weeks with a friend, Pagasian.
Yes.
And as I say, they found the parchment from the Sarmon Monastery. And then he realized that the ancient wisdom societies could answer his question of the sense and significance of life on Earth and human life in particular. But look at the answer he finally comes to, that from nature's perspective, we're doing our duty just by living. Receiving energies, transmitting them, what have you. It doesn't matter whether you're driving a cab or you're a commander in chief or whatever you are from nature's perspective. And when you die, you're going to die, and that will be it, unless you have developed yourself so to the degree that you have a Kejden body, which can survive death. So That seems to me to be the aim for everyone, unless you don't mind becoming fertilizer, as Gurdjieff says.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, this has just been really...
Yeah, it's been really, 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 really good to talk to you, Mr. Patterson. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
Oh, thank you.
Some of your stories and insights.
Yeah, I'd just like to say as well that Mr. Patterson's latest book, Georgi Ivanovich Gurdjieff, The Man, The Teaching, His Mission, it's available from his website, which is gurdjieflegacy.org.
So y'all get over there, because this is probably the definitive
compendium of
Gurdjieff.
Yeah.
And I know that most of our listeners are going to be interested in getting that, because we get questions all the time, and I tell them, go read William Patrick Patterson's book.
Well, yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you, William.
Thank you so much.
And best of luck.
It's been a great pleasure.
Indeed.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Wow, he's 77.
What a delightful person. Just absolutely delightful.
Yeah.
And just so full of knowledge and depth and insight. You know, he's right on top of everything. I mean, just...
11 books. If you go to his website, actually, he's got a few videos also available. I think one he produced himself, similar kind of to his book, kind of Life and Times of Gurdjieff. He also gives some talks. There's a very interesting video where he compares the teachings of Castaneda, Carlos Castaneda, with Gurdjieff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he's responsible for the discovery, but he does touch on how the similarities are clearly that Castaneda's Don Juan and the teaching there stem from what Gurdjieff was saying.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Castaneda. He ripped off Gurdjieff right and left. And,
oh, yeah.
And Patterson also wrote a book about, I think it was called The Life and Teachings of Carlos Castaneda, but he goes through it all and has some pretty definitive links showing that Castaneda was at least, aware of Gurdjieff. And,
absolutely. Yeah. We know it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's, I think we even found at one point a connection where, didn't we at one point find a connection where we knew that Castaneda was in the right place at the right time to have been aware or that he mentioned it or something?
I thought that was in Patterson's book. But
maybe it was in Patterson's book. Yeah. You know, because that was just pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
So.
All right, folks, we're going to leave it there for this week. Thanks to Mr. Patterson again, and thanks to all of our co-hosts and to our chatters and to our listeners. We'll be back next week with another show. Until then, have a good one. Bye-bye from everybody and all of us and everything.
Have a great one.
All and everything.
And
bye-bye.
Everything.
Bye-bye.